TKUT. This is Tuesday Morning After. It's about 20 to 8. We will continue our look at the Canadian prison industrial complex, started last week, by turning now to Justin Pichet, a co-editor of the Prisoner's Journal, interviewed for CKUT last week by Alana McNevin. This is part one of the interview.
Hi, my name is Justin Pichet, and I'm a professor of sociology at Memorial University and co-managing editor of the Journal of Prisoners and author of the blog Tracking the Politics of Crime and Punishment in Canada.
Thanks so much. Now, this interview is part of a special prison literature broadcast that I'm doing for CKUT that is reviewing a comic book published by the PM Press in 2008. The comic book is entitled The Real Cost of Prisons and criticizes the U.S. industrial prison complex. And although it's published in 2008 and focuses on the U.S., there are a lot of issues that are comparable to our situation here in Canada. And the comic book also serves as a quick introduction or a quick education on the prison industrial complex and provides a picture of what Canada might be or will eventually face with the changes proposed in Bill C-10. It covers the direct costs of prisons, which include the costs paid by different levels of government on, you know, for example, courts, policing, and prison expansion, the building of prisons. It also covers the indirect costs of mass incarceration borne by the poor and people who depend on government services like public health, education, healthcare, or housing. First, let's talk about I'd like to talk to you about the indirect costs. Now, changing the dichotomy between the public and prisoners, or ensuring that issues like mental health services and other essential services for prisoners be taken seriously, you know, in other words, ensuring that these services are provided for and paid for effectively. While avoiding this sort of deadly soft-on-crime critique that usually stops all debates and all progress, when trying to debate this issue, it's difficult. In order to address this, can you outline who are in our prisons and what are the costs to communities, families, and individuals with the bill being proposed?
Sure. Well, before Bill C-10 was tabled, provinces and territories across the country were in the process of establishing a new penal infrastructure. So provincial territorial authorities are responsible for incarcerating people awaiting trial and also responsible for incarcerating people who are serving sentences of 2 years minus a day. So at that level, they've been in the process of building 22 new prisons, 17 additions to existing facilities that will add close to 6,300 new prisoner beds at a construction cost of approximately $3.4 billion. That doesn't include the cost for operating and managing each of those prisoner beds, which, according to Statistics Canada in 2008-2009, was on average $59,000 per year. Now, the main reason that the provinces and territories have been pursuing the projects that I just mentioned is because they've had a long-standing increase in the number and proportion of people in their prisons on remand, basically awaiting trial, awaiting their sentences. So, for instance, in 1986-87 to 1996-97, the percentage of people in provincial territorial prisons that were awaiting that were on remand were between 23% and 30% of that population. 2000-2001, that number jumped to 40%, and then 2004-2005, 50%, and then 2009-2010, nearly 6 out of every 10 prisoners in the provincial territorial facilities were awaiting trial or sentencing. So that means if me or you, we walked into every prison at the provincial territorial level in this country, we would meet more people who had either not been convicted or sentenced yet than people who had been. So that's the main justification behind most of the projects. They also, authorities justify building these new facilities because they want to be able to spatially segregate and provide specialized programming to what they call a so-called changing prisoner population. They're claiming that the number of Aboriginal people in our prisons are rising, which is the case. For instance, they represent 3% of our general population in Canada, yet represent 18% of the people in federal penitentiaries and 27% of people in provincial territorial prisons. In 2008-2009, according to Statistics Canada again. They also have been pointing to the longstanding, recent increase in the number of criminalized women in their prisons. There's additional people who are said to be suffering from mental illness issues and also substance abuse issues. So these are the types of needs that are being identified by prison authorities, and rather than addressing these in our communities before victimization occurs, the solution that we seem to be pursuing is to spend more money on incarcerating the individuals who end up slipping through the cracks of our social services. So in terms of thinking about, well, shouldn't we equip our prisons to address the needs of those people that come into conflict with the law, I think that's the backwards approach to addressing those complex issues, and that if we're seriously interested in addressing their needs, we have to do it before they come into conflict with the law, because once they enter prisons, history has shown that the imperatives of security and control within institutions displace any programming objectives that institutions have. So it means, for instance, if you're running a program and then all of a sudden there's an incident at one end of the institution, they throw the penal institution into a lockdown. That means all the programming that's going on, that institution is temporarily on hold, and these interruptions happen frequently in prisons, not just lockdowns, but, you know, squabbles between prisoners and staff, and so on. This is not an ideal environment to be addressing mental health issues, especially when you're stuffing people into cells, often two or three people at the provincial territorial level. You know, I think we need to be thinking about trying to address those needs that folks have, so that we can prevent the victimization, save those costs, but also save the massive prison costs that are associated with that. So I think that's where we need to go, because the prison is a proven failure.
Is there a study, or are you aware of the social costs of a prison being put in a town? For example, in the book that I'm also reviewing, they talk about prison towns, and when a prison comes in, it has a negative effect on the town itself. It creates jobs, but at the same time, it reduces other types of growth, it doesn't encourage other types of growth. You know, it doesn't attract businesses, or it attracts the wrong types of businesses. It attracts box stores as opposed to local businesses, and it generally has a negative effect on the population. Are you aware of those types of social costs that are affiliated with the growth of prisons?
Sure. We can't speak of the Canadian context, but because we haven't had or we're starting to have it, we haven't had yet the massive prison boom that jurisdictions in the United States have had. But there is an emerging body of literature based out of the United States that does study the impact, the social costs of establishing prisons, particularly in rural communities. And basically what that emerging literature is starting to find is that, although, yes, you create those short-term construction jobs and you create those long-term prison jobs, there's costs elsewhere. So, for instance, Tracy Hulling, in her work, talks about this idea that when you build a prison, the municipalities tend to give tax breaks to that particular prison industry. They also direct infrastructure funds towards building roads and water, sewer, hydro, directed towards those facilities. And when that happens, it basically divests investments that would otherwise be made in other parts of the rural economy towards attracting other forms of businesses. You mentioned this idea of big box stores coming in. When those things happen, companies like Walmart, like McDonald's, and so on, when they see a new large industry entering a town, say a prison, they often follow suit because they assume that there will be some growth that will occur as a result of these long-term permanent jobs that are entering those communities. What ends up happening is that people who are currently owning smaller hardware stores or smaller type restaurants, those folks tend to get run out of business, according to Tracy Hulling's work. There's also loss in terms of affordable living for the individuals who have lived in those towns for a long time. So let's say you're renting an apartment in a given city, a large prison is about to be built in your backyard, land speculation goes up, your rent goes up, your bills go up, and you're basically have a higher cost of living, which impedes you from spending whatever money you may have had extra in the community in which you live. And all of these things have led some folks to make the argument that essentially these are forms of economic rather than carceral stimulus. What you're actually looking at is depressing these local economies. At the same time that different prison authorities and politicians are advertising that this is creating jobs, what they don't consider is the types of jobs that they're indeed creating. Prisons are not nice places. They're not nice places for prisoners, and they're certainly not nice places for people to work in. We can think of the Zimbardo work that he did, when he put a number of his students in the role of prisoners, a number of his students in the role of staff, and what ended up happening there and the calamity that ensued, the abuses and the violence that happened between those folks. These are things that are playing out on a daily basis across Canada, across the United States. This does not lend itself to having, healthy family life, healthy community lives. These things tend to spill out into the community. There's a researcher by the last name of Shea that did some work in Pennsylvania that showed this very thing. So it's not the type of patronage project you'd like to see in your community, because the violence and pain that is inside those prison walls inevitably spill out into the communities where these facilities are located. And folks often don't think about that. Sure, it might be some long-term employment for some folks, but there are collateral consequences in terms of the local economies and other industries in those regions, and also impacts on the people and families that are affected by that type of work. We also have to think about the fact that when these prisons are often built in rural settings, you're creating serious challenges in terms of the communities that you're taking these prisoners from. Often people advance the idea that by incapacitating someone, you're essentially taking out the bad guys out of circulation for a while. And when people advance those arguments, they fail to acknowledge that many of these folks who are in prison were making positive contributions otherwise to, let's say, their families or their communities in other respects. Someone convicted of an offense, that's not the only thing that they've contributed to their communities in most instances. I'm not talking about, serial killers here. I'm talking about people who are convicted of other things. And we need to think about that. When you take these people, particularly people that have families, out of circulation, to use Stephen Harper's words, you're essentially causing financial damage to those families. You're causing dislocation, and other things like that. And I think, if we'd like to promote, healthy upbringings and the like, keeping families together is an important part of that. So basically what you're doing is you're plundering people from often urban communities to benefit rural communities who often really don't benefit all that much from these prison industries. And, we do have to keep that into consideration, whether or not we want this type of human plundering to go on in the name of so-called public safety. I think we have to take a deep breath and do some research and look into what the collateral consequences of increasing our reliance on incarceration are going to be.
Thank you for that. That was really interesting. Moving now to the direct costs that are often affiliated with the expansion of prisons, I'm using the term prison industrial complex, which originated from the United States and the situation that they have. But it's essentially a term that has come to represent the physical system of prisons and courthouses and police stations, all the people who work in and for these institutions, and all the companies who sell goods or services to prisons and jails, and the cost to operate, manage, and fill the prisons as well. I'm wondering, will the expected increase in costs be accommodated without exceeding 100% capacity of the correctional facilities and without increasing our current deficit?
I think in terms of what we're doing, in a context where provinces and territories, for instance, weren't even considering, for the most part, except for Newfoundland, Labrador, PEI, and Ontario, considering the type of measures that the federal government was putting forward as they were planning the facilities that I described at the beginning of the interview. Mm-hmm. It basically means that most of these jurisdictions, now that they're thinking about Bill C-10, that's going to add people serving sentences of 2 years minus a day with all the mandatory minimums with the drugs, drug trafficking and drug production and the like, and also further restricting conditional sentences. It basically means that all these jurisdictions that were trying to get away from these massively overcrowded prisons may find themselves at square one, which then again leads us to more prison construction. At the federal level, they're just starting to put different facilities online. They're just starting to build them, in fact, across the country, 34 additions to existing facilities that will add over 2,500 new prisoner beds at a construction cost of $601 million. And each prisoner bed on average in federally in this country is $118,000 a year, according to Statistics Canada. So to answer your question in short, yes, we are going to be borrowing money from my generation and the generations that are younger than mine to basically fund prison expansion in this country. And that money has to come from somewhere. Most provinces and territories are in deep financial trouble. Our federal government is in deep financial trouble. They're either going to have to cut social services or raise taxes, start charging lots of user fees in order to balance the books. That's the reality of the situation. And when our federal government is going on this punishment binge, it's just going to exacerbate those challenges. And this is why you've seen in the last last few weeks, a lot of the provinces and territories, some have supported the legislation, others like Quebec have not, but they've all stuck their hand out and said, if you're going to do this, give us some money, because we don't have the money to fund this kind of stuff. We don't have money to fund this incarceration binge.
Welcome back to CKUT 90.3 FM. You are listening to Democracy Now, the Tuesday edition. Tuesday morning after with Democracy Now coming up in a few seconds. Stay tuned.